She will be speaking on treatment compliance among Chicago healthcare providers in response to new gonococcal treatment guidelines. Welcome.
So thank you for being here on the last day of the conference. I know everyone wants to run away and go home. I'd like to start by thanking my co-investigators, Tracy Nicholson, Irina Tabidze, Ifeanyi Chukwudozi, Nanette Bembo. So I won't spend a lot of time on this because we've all seen these slides repeatedly now. But in 2012, August, the CDC treatment guidelines, the recommendations for gonorrhea treatment were revised to recommend ceftriaxone 250 in conjunction with azithromycin or doxycycline. And this was in response to the increasing resistance in oral cephalosporins that cefixime and the other oral cephalosporins were no longer recommended. However, prior to the official update to the guidelines in August of 2012, there was a notification through MMWR in July of 2011 that recommended at that time that healthcare providers should switch to 250 milligram ceftriaxone injection only in conjunction with azithromycin or doxycycline. So the changing landscape of treatment regimens for gonorrhea, it's been highly labile over the past 10 to 20 years. This is not new. And here, these red vertical bars indicate updates to treatment recommendation guidelines, and the dashed bars indicate the notification updates, so when there were changes that weren't official. So the period that we're talking about here is 2010, 2011, 2012. So our goal was to assess trends in adherence to CDC treatment recommendations for gonorrhea among non-Chicago Department of Public Health care laboratory-confirmed cases from April 1st of 2011 through July of 2012. This was a retrospective analysis of lab-confirmed cases that were reported to the Chicago Department of Public Health, which I'll refer to as CDPH. We chose this time period because we wanted a baseline period prior to the treatment notification update in July of 2011, and also with the period ending prior to the official update to the guidelines, which was August of 2012. So our two time periods for comparison are a baseline period of April through July of 2011, and then a comparison period after the notification for August of 2011 through July of 2012. Data on the cases is extracted from iNet, which is the Illinois National Electronic Disease Surveillance System. It's a web-based portal that's capable of receiving electronic laboratory records and morbidity reports. Through this, we extracted, of course, the results of the gonorrhea test, and then the client's gender, age, race, ethnicity, and the provider type. Cases represent those individuals who were presenting with symptoms, presenting for screening as contacts to suspected cases, and who, of course, also submitted specimens for testing. So we did initially in the abstract include data for the CDPH cases as a comparison, but what we found in the final analysis is that when there was a change in the electronic medical record coding in March of 2012 that led to a lot of missing data. So I'm only presenting the non-CDPH data here today, but what you read in the abstract is generally correct that we can validate through March of 2012, which is that CDPH had about 90% compliance with treatment guidelines. In terms of defining what was adherent versus non-adherent therapy for the analysis, in period one, we of course used the CDC guidelines for uncomplicated infections of the urethra, cervix, and rectum. So the recommendations were either ceftriaxone 250 milligrams as a single intramuscular injection, cefixime 400 if the ceftriaxone were unavailable, or other single dose injectable cephalosporin regimens. And then, of course, dual therapy, again, with azithromycin or doxycycline. The alternative single-dose injectables are listed below, and the alternative regimens included cefpodoxime in conjunction with azithromycin or doxycycline, or azithromycin 2 grams for those who had allergy. In the second period, which was after the notification in July of 2011, it was now recommended only for ceftriaxone 250 in conjunction with azithromycin or doxycycline. However, cefixime was still acceptable in cases where ceftriaxone was not available. And the alternative regimens now no longer included cefpodoxime or other single injectable cephalosporins, and it was only azithromycin 2 grams. For analysis, these were the definitions we used, but additionally, those patients who received intravenous therapy were considered to have been appropriately treated. And then cases with missing treatment data were excluded from analysis. So during this period, there were nearly 10,000 laboratory-confirmed cases of gonorrhea that were reported to CDPH. However, as you see here in red, nearly half the cases had missing treatment information. So this left us with 5,046 cases with complete treatment information that were available for analysis. Of course, with this much missing treatment information, we have to be concerned as to what is being over or underrepresented in our patient sample. So the cases with missing treatment information were more likely to be non-Hispanic other. They were less likely to be non-Hispanic black, 56% of those with missing treatment information versus 78% of those with complete treatment information, which means that we are significantly overestimating, overrepresenting blacks in our population. They had the same distribution of age and the same distribution of gender, but so the racial distribution was significantly different between the half of the cases with complete treatment information and the other half with missing treatment information. So with this much missing data, we want to look at what are the sources of this, because this is also a potential point of intervention. So this chart is showing on the y-axis the proportion of cases with missing data, and then what we see is the provider type with the bubbles, and the size of the bubble represents the contribution, the number of laboratory confirmed cases. There's a simple regression line there, and what we see is that there's a general overall trend that was statistically significant in which the there's decreasing proportion of missing data associated with increasing number of confirmed cases. So that makes sense. Those who are high volume providers are going to have a little bit somewhat better performance in terms of recording treatment data. Of concern is up here we have online testing services. While they only contributed 187 of the confirmed cases, they had 97% missing treatment data. So as we shift into an era of promoting online testing for gonorrhea and chlamydia, this is a bit of a problem if 97% of them are unable to provide treatment information. So we don't know if the cases are, treatment is not recorded, if they're not receiving treatment, if they're not receiving their results. We don't know what's going on there. There were a handful of cases from the Veterans Administration with over 80% missing data. So any clients who are going to these types of venues would not be represented in our analysis. The kind of the lowest rate of missing data came from schools and jails and prisons, and contributing about 80% of the reported cases were private providers, community health centers, and hospital and medical centers. And so they had similar rates of missing data, but it was a bit better for the hospitals and medical centers. So now moving on to the results of the cases themselves. So on the left here, this graphic is showing the distribution of cases between the two time periods. So what is the frequency of cases? And simply what this is showing us is that there was no trend over time in the volume or the frequency of cases with non-CDPH providers. The cases were 57% female, 43% male. The median age was 21. The range was 13 to 72. And there were two outliers outside of the age range of 72. By race, they were 78% non-Hispanic black, and that is a bit higher than what you'll see in other national profiles. And again, we've got some overrepresentation because there was less missing treatment data for non-Hispanic blacks compared to other racial categories. Between the two periods, their treatment adequacy improved from 56% in the first period to nearly 70% in the second period. So, of course, this is going to be a decrease in inadequate treatment from 44% to 32%. In terms of the distribution of what were the regimens that were adequate, of course, these were all dual therapies, and predominantly it was ceftriaxone in conjunction with azithromycin or doxycycline. And this was two-thirds of adequate treatment regimens in the first period and about 85% of adequate treatment regimens in the second period. There was kind of some minor distribution for the other cephalosporin oral regimens, and then alternative acceptable decreased from 5% in the first period to about 3% in the second period. So in terms of the distribution of inadequate therapies, largely this was due to single therapy with ceftriaxone, 250 milligrams IM. There were some other oral cephalosporins accounting for about 10% of the inadequate single therapy regimens. And then what we see here, a positive change in terms of inadequate therapies, single therapy with ceftriaxone, 125 milligrams, decreased from 13% to 4%. So this is good that that the use of the lower doses is tapering off. In a handful of cases, about 15% in both period one and period two, the clients received single therapy for chlamydia trachomatis, and largely this was azithromycin with 1 gram. In terms of the overall distribution of ceftriaxone versus oral cephalosporins, it increased from about 70% with any ceftriaxone to just over 80% from period one to period two. And then oral cephalosporins, about 6 or 7% to about 5% in period two. So we're seeing a shift towards the injectables, which is what the notification and the guidelines are urging. In terms of the trends over time, there was an increase. And here I've marked with the blue vertical line would be the change from period one to period two. We don't see a strong inflection point there. It's more of a gradual increase. So we were hoping there would be an inflection point, but there really it looks like the change started a few months before the notification release. A second potential inflection point, CDPH distributed a memo to the constituents in March of 2012, reminding them of the notification, and we also don't see any dramatic change subsequent to that memo. In terms of by provider type, from the first period to the second period, there were increases for all groups except for emergency department and urgent or immediate care and private providers. So this is good news overall that there were significant increases, community health centers, family planning, OB-GYN, and reproductive health. It's a bit unfortunate with the private providers, it stayed stable, and they are a large contributor for the lab-confirmed gonorrhea cases. In terms of patient factors, looking at the distribution of adequate treatment, we find that males were much more likely than females to receive adequate treatment, 73% versus 59%. Adolescents, 13 to 19, somewhat less likely than the older age groups, with 60% receiving adequate treatment compared to about 70% for young adults. Non-Hispanic blacks, 66% adequate treatment, and this was similar for non-Hispanic whites and for Hispanics, though a bit lower for non-Hispanic other. And again, we see an increase of 56% to 68% period one to period two. So we did use multivariable negative binomial regression to estimate the prevalence rate ratios, and they are very much in keeping with the crude results. So a 20% decreased likelihood of adherent treatment for females, some increases that were significant for adolescents, young adults compared to adolescents, a lower likelihood of adequate treatment for non-Hispanic other. So adherence improved over time from 56% to 68%, but it was a gradual increase. So some of the reasons for this increase, we aren't entirely certain of them. It just may be improving awareness over time, increasing news reports, journal articles. We found that there was significant variation in the proportion of inadequate treatment by provider type, but that mostly this was due to single therapy with ceftriaxone 250 milligrams. So there are two reasons that the CDC recommends dual therapy, and one is that it's hypothesized that dual therapy with drugs that have two different mechanisms can slow or delay the emergence of resistance, but as we may have heard in Dr. Rice's talk yesterday, that might not necessarily be the case. However, the second reason for doing dual therapy is that many of these patients, they present symptomatically, and it's unknown whether it's gonorrhea or chlamydia due to the confluence of symptoms, and there's high co-infection rates. So this also highlights the need for rapid and point-of-care testing so that we can have, if it comes to be that we need single therapy, that's going to be more advantageous, then we can have targeted therapy. Women were less likely to receive adequate therapy. We hypothesized this could be a result of either screen-detected versus symptomatic infections and also the nonspecific nature of infections in women. We found that inadequate treatment regimens in women often included levofloxacin and other things that would reflect suspicion of another disease process. The limitations, of course, this is retrospective chart analysis, so there could be some invalidity in the record match leading to missing data. We could have multiple visits by single individuals. In terms of classification by provider type, we found that a third of the cases came from hospitals and medical centers. And of course, within this, there are many different provider types. It could also be emergency departments, urgent care, ambulatory care, and the precision of coding is not there. So it's all falling under this umbrella of hospital and medical center. So this is important in terms of targeting the interventions, in terms of there was so much missing data. Is it that they're not being treated or that it's simply not recorded? So that's definitely an area of intervention. There could also be misclassification of therapy provided. So we looked at 9 different treatment fields, and in some cases it was written azithromycin 250 milligrams instead of azithromycin 250 milligrams times 4, or doxycycline 100 milligrams instead of doxycycline 100 milligrams BID times 7 or 14. So in those cases, we are forced to code that as inadequate therapy, and it may just be poor charting on the part of the clinician. So that's another bit of feedback that we can give. We could be underestimating adequate treatment due to charting. So our future directions and recommendations stem from the CDC's 4 core actions for stemming antimicrobial resistance. So in addition to having a third period, so of course we're waiting for that surveillance data, but we can extend our analysis to have a period 3, which is after the official update to the treatment recommendation guidelines. But additionally, in the guidelines, we now see that test of cure at 1 week is recommended if there is a different cephalosporin use than what is recommended. So we don't really know to what extent that's being done, if at all. And what efforts are being made for treatment of sex partners? Are there additional efforts on the parts of private providers or community health centers or the hospitals and medical systems? So these are additional components of evaluation of treatment compliance that need to be added. In terms of using this data to directly improve adherence, we found several helpful things that could be used as provider feedback. And I think one of the simplest and perhaps most efficient ways could be provider feedback through in-services, additional memorandums, and also encouraging them to have consultation with the health department. So in cases where ceftriaxone may not be available, you know, that they can call or they can find out, how do we get this drug? Can we send the patient there? What else can we use? So really encouraging more communication with the constituents. So of these healthcare providers, there were 527 different reporting sources, but 10 reporting sources accounted for 59% of all of the laboratory-confirmed cases, 8 hospital systems, 1 community health center, and then the jail and detention centers. So this really makes it quite feasible to target these intervention approaches to these few locales that could have a significant impact on improving provider adherence with treatment. So lastly, for addressing resistance, obviously we've all been talking about this, the expanded partner services for gonorrhea cases. So I think I was told yesterday that we have 29 DIS for all of Chicago, and with about 10,000 gonorrhea cases confirmed occurring in a 16-month period, that makes it very difficult to say, how do we target partner services? So maybe we can somehow combine this with our Google Trends surveillance to identify those people who would most benefit. But then also ensuring adherence on the part of the providers in terms of follow-up at 1 week or notification of partners, or adherence for the clients who are getting doxycycline, so looking at those different things. And then maintaining and supporting culture capabilities. So with such a large number of cases and some hospital systems accounting for hundreds, if not thousands, of the reported cases, perhaps implementing some local surveillance for gonorrhea resistance and sensitivity. So I'd like to thank you and take any questions at this time.
Eva Enns from the University of Minnesota School of Public Health. I just had a couple maybe small detail questions, but did you look at breaking men into men who have sex with men and men who exclusively have sex with women, and maybe men who have sex with men are more appropriately treated? And then would you get in your data, would you have updates to treatment? So women who are initially kind of suspected of this, but it came back positive for gonorrhea then?
Yeah. So the first question was about if we could divide men into men who have sex with men and men who have sex with women. And I think that's a really important question, and we don't have that information because it came from INAs and they're non-CDPH providers, so they don't collect that data. So, but yeah, that would be very important to look at. The second question was about updated treatment. So there were 9 treatment fields and all the different dates, and we took all of that information. And it does update periodically, but I know from having worked in surveillance that the clinicians and the hospital systems can batch their morb reports. So they may send it once a month or once a quarter. So I don't know if things that are greatly delayed make it into the system, if they're doing that. Yeah. All right. Thank you.